We're following the news that President Trump and the First Lady have tested positive for the coronavirus. White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows said today that the president has mild symptoms.
He continues to be not only in good spirits, but very energetic. We've talked a number of times this morning. I got the five or six things that he had tasked me to do like I do every single morning.
Melania Trump tweeted today that she also has mild symptoms, but is overall feeling good.
Meanwhile, a White House spokesperson said today that Judge Amy Coney Barrett has tested negative for the virus. She spent time with the president last weekend. And Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell is pledging to continue her Supreme Court confirmation process. Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden's physician said today that Biden has tested negative. Biden says he's praying for the health and safety of the president and wishes him a full recovery. NPR's White House correspondent is Franco Ordonez. And Franco, what exactly do we know about the president's condition now?
Well, as you noted at the top, the chief of staff, Mark Meadows, is saying that the president exhibited mild symptoms. But at the same time, you know, he's also saying that, you know, that the president is working and that they're talking about important issues of the day, including the economy and stimulus talks. He's making the case that he's not lying in bed, but it's also clear that the president has have a limited schedule today with only one call planned, and that was on the coronavirus and supporting vulnerable seniors.
Okay, so they're portraying him as continuing with his presidential responsibilities. The president is 74 years old. His weight is categorized as obese. These are risk factors for serious complications. Again, it said he has only mild symptoms. The pandemic has now taken the lives of more than 200,000 Americans. The president said early on it would go away by Easter. He has mocked the use of face masks. He's made inaccurate statements about them, and he's pushed forward with rallies and a lot of travel and meeting a lot of people. How will the issue of his credibility and the very fact that he is sick and must now stay at the White House and off the campaign trail affect the campaign?
Well, I think it could have a very large campaign on the campaign, an impact on the campaign. I mean, it's already brought immediate plans to a halt. The president was supposed to hold rallies in Florida tonight and Wisconsin tomorrow. I mean, clearly the president is a very big fan of doing rallies. But obviously all this kind of thing hinges on his health and how he comes through this.
What steps is the White House taking to try and trace his recent contacts? It's been an incredibly busy week for him, even after the debate.
Yes. Mark Meadows talked about this and said that they are doing contact tracing, that they have reached out to a lot of the members who have been close with the president, as well as Hope Hicks. Hope Hicks is the senior advisor who initially contracted the virus. Now, the White House is keeping most of the health information private, citing HIPAA laws. But Meadows also did note that the core staff have tested negative, as well as we're hearing from several cabinet members today who have also tested negative, most notably Vice President Mike Pence, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, Secretary of Treasury Steve Mnuchin, for example.
And for those who haven't been tested or for whom we don't know the results, are staffers who had contact with the president being asked to quarantine?
Well, we do know that Hope Hicks has been isolated. As for others, we are, you know, learning that. And, you know, we do know that they're contact tracing. But as I noted, they're trying to be very private and keep those health information private.
The second presidential debate, Franco, is scheduled for October 15th in Miami. What is the campaign saying about whether or not there's any way that debate could still happen?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great point. I mean, this is less than 2 weeks away. You know, most quarantines are about 14 days, 2 weeks. The White House, an official did speak about this with one of my colleagues, Tamara Keith, and that official said they are hoping to still work that out. But obviously, again, that's going to depend on the president's health. And at this point, that seems, you know, difficult to see.
And when you speak with those at the White House, what are they telling you about the kind of zeitgeist there? I mean, it must be an incredibly anxious and concerning time. What are you hearing from them?
Yeah, I mean, it is definitely a very anxious time. You could see that kind of in Mark Meadows' mannerisms as well as his space. There's a lot of pressure on White House as well as White House staff to, come out and, present a positive front. But this is very difficult news. This is very challenging news. As the chief of staff said, they likely to expect more cases coming out.
NPR White House correspondent Franco Ordonez. Thanks very much, Franco.
Thank you.
And the news broke early this morning when President Trump announced on Twitter that he and the First Lady had tested positive for the coronavirus. Joining us now is Femi Okeh, host of the stream on Al Jazeera English. She follows the news through social media. And Femi, I guess it's just a sign of the times that we live in that the president broke this historic news on Twitter even before the White House officially confirmed that he was infected.
Of course, no filter, talking directly to America. And I did a little bit of research and analysis on that particular tweet because in the early hours of the morning, they were getting lots of likes. It was getting lots of likes, lots of retweets. And it looked really unusual for how popular it was for a presidential tweet. More than 1 million people by Friday morning had actually liked this tweet. I checked using a tool called Tweet Binder. And so far, it is the most retweeted tweet of President Trump's history.
Wow. That is good to know. How else are people responding online? What are they saying?
The debate about masks continues with a little bit more focus, obviously. And then also, there are some questions about, has the president really got COVID-19? For instance, Murray_NYC is a very popular poll right now. Yes, I believe it. The president has coronavirus. No, it's a hoax. There are over 170,000 votes so far. You can join in that debate if you want to. But it also underlines the idea of the president often talks about fake news. And then when he has news, people are questioning whether that news is real or fake.
I guess we should say officially, we have no reason to believe that this is not a real diagnosis. However, as you point out,
we have no reason to believe, but that doesn't matter on Twitter.
Exactly. It doesn't matter on Twitter. President Trump also is not the first world leader to test positive for the virus. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, of course, we remember this, was in intensive care with COVID-19. How have he and other world leaders reacted to this? Are they talking about the diagnosis?
Some empathy from PM Boris Johnson. He says, my best wishes to President Trump and the First Lady. Hope they both have a speedy recovery. Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi has a really good relationship with President Trump. He's saying, wish you, my friend, at POTUS, at Real Donald Trump, and floaters a quick recovery and good health. And then a fascinating subtweet from Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, who is the head of the World Health Organization. My best wishes to at Real Donald Trump and floaters for a full and speedy recovery. And he subtweets the president's news on Twitter that he has COVID-19. That one's fascinating.
Yeah. All right. We're going to keep a close eye on this story. But Femi, you remind us every week that when the world is gripped with this kind of uncertainty and when we're in these trying moments, that social media, yes, can be a very difficult place, but also it can be one for refuge or escape. So bring us a moment of joy. If you can. Tell us about Sir David Attenborough, whose star is rising even further, if that's possible.
I know. A record-breaking Instagram account. So in the past week, Sir David Attenborough, whose Instagram account is, so you can all go and see it, at David Attenborough, it made records. It made news for being the fastest account to get 1 million followers. And in the past week, his posts are getting 2 million likes, a million likes, and all because he's talking about a story on a new film that's coming up, which is his connection to nature and the earth and the planet. And that's going to be on Netflix, David Attenborough, A Life on Our Planet. And he even talks about why it's important, why he, at 94 years old, is talking about climate action.
Well, and we have some tape from that video. Let's listen.
I wish I wasn't involved in this struggle. Because I wish the struggle wasn't there or necessary. But I've had unbelievable luck, and I certainly would feel very guilty if I saw what the problems are and decided to ignore them.
Wow. As you said, 94 years old. How is the public responding to this online?
Oh, with great love and admiration and literally hanging on every post. And if you go to Instagram, you will find David Attenborough right there and see some of the beautiful films that he's been making. And also, he's unfiltered now. He's talking about climate action. He's talking about the climate crisis. And because of all his years as a natural history host and broadcaster, you feel that there is some real solid experience behind his viewpoints.
You have to listen when he talks. Femi Okay is host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English. Femi, thanks as always. Have a great weekend.
You too. Take care, Peter.
More than 7 million Americans have tested positive for the coronavirus, and as we learned early this morning, the President of the United States is among them. President Trump announced his positive test results on Twitter. First Lady Melania Trump has also tested positive, so has a close aide to the president, Hope Hicks, and Republican National Committee Chairwoman Ronna McDaniel. This morning, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi wished the president well on MSNBC.
Every infection is a sad one. The president of the United States, of course, but every single one. Now we've gone over in such a high number in our country of infections, every one of them a sad occasion. Over 209,000 deaths, a tragedy beyond even comprehension 1 year ago, and still more to come. But maybe this will be the moment where people will say, okay, mask. Distance, sanitation, tracing, treatment.
The United States has more coronavirus infections than any other country in the world, and by far the highest death toll. The U.S. has 4% of the world's population, but has seen 20% of the pandemic deaths. And as the president and his close contacts contend with an outbreak inside the White House, many critics say they could have prevented the infection by taking basic precautions and could have stopped the virus in its tracks if only there had been the political will. Andy Slavitt led the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services under President Obama. We spoke yesterday via Skype before the news about the president's infection broke, and I asked him about an argument that he made back in July in an article for Medium when he said that the United States is always 4 to 6 weeks away from eliminating the virus if we throw the kitchen sink at the problem.
Well, one way to look at what's going on is to look at the numbers you said. You specifically drill in on a place like Africa. Africa is a continent with 1.3 billion people, and they have about 30,000 deaths. What that should tell us is that what we have ahead of us to do is not all that high tech, not all that complex. It really involves a little bit of discipline and a little bit of sacrifice and a little bit of experience and a little bit of empathy would be, I think, the right formula. It's all about very simply not breathing near one another in crowded places. You know, in the scheme of viruses, that's a pretty easy formula, considering that there are viruses that are much more contagious. So we can do this with a series of actions that have been demonstrated around the world. We just have to decide if we want to do it.
Yeah. And let's go through some of those tactics. Your kitchen sink has six parts to it. We can't get to all of them, but we can get to a few here. Starting with universal mask wearing. How do you do that? Is that a national mask mandate?
Well, look, we have to stop fighting each other about masks and start listening to each other about masks and start appealing to each other about masks. You know, we know that there are plenty of people, large majorities of the people, that if told that it will save people's lives, will wear masks. We know there are others who have other questions, individual liberties. Maybe they have their own concerns. Maybe they're in low density areas. And we got to listen to those concerns instead of being instantly dismissive, or we're never going to get those people on board. There's no penalty. There's no law that's going to do the job. I do think it starts with a president who will wear a mask himself or herself, demonstrate why it's important, and get all the governors to do the same. Once that happens, I think we'll be much, much, much closer. Right now, we're not even putting in close to the effort that we need.
You're also calling for a near total lockdown, 90%. What would that look like?
So here's what I mean and here's what I don't mean. The last time we went through kind of stay-at-home orders in April, nearly half the population was serving the people that were staying home, picking crops, delivering food, keeping things open. We call these essential workers, but in effect, what it meant is the virus circulated much more significantly than we knew. So a number of us were staying home, but many of us were not. So if we want to do this and take this seriously, we really have to actually do what they've done in other countries, which is be much more limited in terms of how many people are circulating. Now, the truth is there's a lot of good news in that there are things that are relatively safe. Individual stores, individual shops, places where people are one-on-one, small family gatherings, those things are relatively safe. We're not concerned about one case of coronavirus. We're concerned about hotspots. There are going to be cases, and we have enough tests for cases. We have enough isolation capability for cases. What we don't have is enough ability to keep schools and universities reliably open if there are outbreaks. So we have to prevent the outbreaks and accept the fact that we can manage the cases aggressively when they come up.
As you know, the most obvious question out of this, I think, is, well, what about the economy? Another 800,000 people filed for unemployment last week, and we're barely locked down at all right now. I mean, what would a 90% lockdown do to the economy that's already kind of in tatters?
Here's the question that needs to be begged. Should we consider some short-term pain for long-term gain? I think other countries have been able to see the benefit of some short-term pain, and then they are much more open. Doesn't mean they're off the hook, but they're much more open. We haven't even had that dialogue in the U.S. I think I'm not calling for any action on my own. What I'm suggesting is that the options have never been put on the table for the American public. The American public has sort of been told this is the only way to do it. And we really need to have a national conversation about, is it worth it to have 6 weeks of short-term pain to get the viral level down to near zero? And are we willing to support the businesses and everybody that will go through financial pain during those 6 weeks? That's the smarter way to do it, in my opinion, because the alternative is we have this economy that limps along endlessly. People aren't traveling. People aren't buying cars. People aren't signing leases. People aren't doing really significant amounts of hiring. They're not going to do that unless they feel safer. And how do they feel safer is to take this work done. Now, I talked about this in the summer very specifically because my suggestion was if people wanted schools to open, they had that in their power. Don't go to bars, wear masks, bring the viral count down, and schools will be able to safely open. We have yet to be able to do that, but my point is anytime we want to, it's really about 6 weeks away.
Looking at your list, you also suggest that hotels could be used to isolate people from their families. You say we could prohibit interstate travel, prohibit travel into the country. These are bold measures, clearly, but the United States couldn't even handle the measures that were put in place back in March. It did very little to slow the virus. What makes you think that we have the political and cultural will to do this?
Well, we may not, and that's something we have to face. But look, we're talking here about are we willing to take some measures for 6 weeks that would save hundreds of thousands of lives? You know, we're relatively speaking very unaccustomed to sacrifice anymore in this country. If you told my grandparents, or I'm guessing yours or many other people listening, that they had to sacrifice for 6 weeks that would save hundreds of thousands of lives and get the economy back, these are people who lived through a 10-year depression. They lived through who knows what kind of turmoil in their own countries if they came to the U.S. They lived through a 6-year world war. And, you know, we talk about the freedom that we want to have to not wear masks and the freedom we have to have free speech and assemble in churches. Where do people think those freedoms came from? Those freedoms came from a responsibility to building a culture, building a society that does require a little bit of sacrifice. And we can't lie to people and tell people this will go away if we don't take some measures. And so we have to choose those measures. That measure can be what we've chosen, which is sort of an endless, no end in sight approach, which allows us to limp along. And some parts of society doing quite well, but unfortunately many parts of society, people who are out there working every day and are required to, not doing very well, and many of them at serious risk. Or we can make a decision that as a society, we're going to try to come together and beat this thing, just like we would beat any enemy.
At this point, why not just wait for a vaccine?
I think people have to understand what a vaccine will and won't do. The vaccine doesn't carry the promise of eradicating COVID-19. A vaccine carries a promise of being a great tool in our arsenal that will dramatically reduce the risk of transmission. But the question we don't know is how much immunity will it confer, on what percentage of the population, or for how long. We should understand that it's more likely to be like a influenza vaccine, which works on 40 to 50% of the population with some levels of effectiveness, but not perfect. And so it will make things easier. It will make things better. But, you know, the U.S. has a habit of waiting for these high-tech scientific solutions to rescue us. And, you know, sometimes that works, but sometimes it requires a little bit on our part. And I'm not suggesting that we do anything other than spend 6 weeks looking out for one another and demonstrating that the people who live among us aren't just strangers we don't care about, but they're people whose lives we're willing to save.
Andy Slavitt led the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services under President Obama. He's also writing a book that will come out next year. It's called Preventable, the inside story of how leadership failures, politics, and selfishness doomed the U.S. coronavirus response. And he's making the case here that the virus could be eradicated in 4 to 6 weeks if there was the political will. Andy, thank you very much.
Anytime.
I spoke with Andy yesterday before news of the president's positive coronavirus test broke. We'll be keeping a close eye on that story throughout the day, how it affects the president's health, what it means for the last month of the presidential campaign. And of course, we'll get reaction from around the country and the world. Wall Street opened lower today following the news that President Trump and the First Lady tested positive for the coronavirus. Trump's announcement adds a new layer of uncertainty as investors scramble to figure out what his diagnosis will mean for the election in just 32 days. They're also digesting the new September jobs report. Let's bring in Mike Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News. And Mike, the Dow fell more than 300 points today at the open. Global markets also plunged after this news broke. What are you seeing?
Right. So it definitely created a sort of knee-jerk reaction in the markets, which is pretty common when investors are confronted with a surprise piece of news like this. Obviously, this reshapes the narrative around the election, which by extension reshapes the entire narrative and thinking about what to expect in the stock market. I would point out, though, Peter, that it does look very much like a knee-jerk reaction. A lot of those losses have been recouped as the day went on. So it'll take a few days, I think, for the market to really digest what this means for the sort of the prospects for the economy as it relates to the election and policies currently being discussed in Washington.
So it sounds like you're saying maybe not a major impact here because investors were already kind of bracing for a messy political fight over the results of this election. So the uncertainty was all already there.
Absolutely. Investors almost universally from my discussions and the notes and messages I've been reading have been preparing for a volatile time after the election, the period between the election and the inauguration in January, simply because President Trump has expressed so much skepticism and suspicion towards the universal mail-in ballot initiatives underway in the country that investors are basically putting on the seatbelts to some degree and preparing for a pretty rocky market in that interim period between the election and the inauguration.
Well, the news broke just a few hours before the Labor Department released the final jobs report that we'll have before the election. We see that the economy added 660,000 new jobs in September, which is far less than it was in August. What did you see in that jobs report? Anything concerning? Again, as we say, this is the last one we'll get before voters go to the polls on November 3rd.
Right. Well, it's clear that that quick snapback in employment that we saw as economies began to reopen is slowing down a little bit. And I would say the figures that have come out, some of the announcements that have come out after the period where this jobs report was surveyed, a lot of announcements of big layoffs. We saw Walt Disney World announcing a lot of layoffs. The airlines are announcing a lot of layoffs. So those are signs that going forward, these job recovery may be even harder to come by, that we could be looking for even weaker numbers going forward.
And just briefly, we see that women lost a lot of ground in this jobs report.
Right, Peter, and I think, you know, look, it's 2020. We've obviously made a lot of progress, but in general, women do make up more of the caregivers for children. So with a lot of kids stuck at home doing school over the internet rather than going actually to a physical school, the burden on that child care is falling probably disproportionately to the women in the workforce. So, yeah. You know, we really need to see the economy get back to a normal situation where schools are open and women who are mothers are able to fully re-enter the workforce.
That's Mike Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News. Thanks as always, Mike. Have a good weekend.
You too, Peter. Thank you.
Earlier this week, President Trump continued to downplay the severity of the coronavirus pandemic. Early this morning, he announced on Twitter that he has tested positive for the virus, so is First Lady Melania Trump. The implications are wide-ranging. We're going to speak about the medical concerns now with our medical contributor, Dr. Lena Wen. She is the emergency physician and public health professor at George Washington University and former health commissioner of Baltimore. Dr. Wen, the president and First Lady Melania are among the more than 42,000 people who just yesterday tested positive for the coronavirus. White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows has said the president has mild symptoms. You are not the president's physician, but based on what you know about his health and from what you've seen among your own patients, I wonder if you can determine what he might expect, if that's possible.
Well, I'm certainly very concerned about the president's health. He is someone, because of his age and because of his pre-existing medical conditions of having obesity and heart disease, is at increased risk. And risk is also additive. And so his age, in addition to these other risk factors, make him more susceptible to having severe effects from COVID-19. I think the time course is also important for us to keep in mind. There is a period of time, the incubation period, between when you are exposed to when you develop symptoms. That could be up to 14 days, an average of 5 to 7 days. So I don't know if what he's showing now are the COVID symptoms or if there's something else. Maybe he has a cold or is just fatigued and that's why he's having these symptoms. But there is another lag of time between when somebody first starts showing symptoms and when they become severely ill. The average time for when somebody ends up, for example, in the ICU is 10 to 12 days after they first start having symptoms. And so, of course, I hope and I pray for a speedy recovery for the president. But I want us to keep in mind that even if it seems like he is doing well for a few days, it doesn't mean that we should take a sigh of relief just yet, that we should still be looking to see what happens, because certainly in my patients and in others, we've seen that there could be a pretty benign clinical course, that they seem to be doing pretty well, but there's still the possibility that after a week or two that they could get worse.
And have you also found that people who are at high risk end up not having a serious course?
Absolutely. So I think it's also important for us to keep in mind that most people will do well. And chances are that the president will have a good outcome and recovery. 40% of patients who have coronavirus don't develop symptoms. And again, we don't know if what the president is currently experiencing are coronavirus symptoms. So he may do very well. But there's also the possibility that he, just like others, may not.
So given the fact that we don't know, of course, what's going to happen, there's so much about this disease that's not known, what is the recommendation for people who have COVID symptoms, even mild ones, according to the CDC? What should the president be doing right now to take care of himself and to keep others safe?
Well, when one has mild symptoms, there isn't treatment that one can take. For example, it's not as if there's a pill that one is able to take to reduce the severity of those symptoms. We just don't have that yet. If someone becomes extremely ill and is in the hospital requiring oxygen, there are actually treatments that have been proven to reduce the length of the illness and also to reduce mortality, specifically corticosteroids and remdesivir, the antiviral. But for someone who's mildly ill, they have what's called symptomatic treatment. So they take it easy, they monitor their symptoms. If they develop a fever, they can take medications for their fever. But it's really important in that time to isolate, to not be around other people. And that's so important for people who have symptoms, because they can certainly spread it to others if they're symptomatic, but even for people who are asymptomatic but have had high concern for exposure. So anyone who has had more than 15 minutes of exposure, 6 feet apart without wearing masks, that person is considered to be at high risk for having a close contact with someone with COVID-19. All of those individuals should be staying away from others for 14 days. And I say this, and I keep on emphasizing this, because I'm hearing reports of the president's staff saying they took a test, it's negative, with the implication that they're now fine. That's not the case at all. Testing does not replace the need for quarantine in those individuals who've had that close contact.
You're saying that even if they test negative, I mean, what's the value of the test then, if you've been around somebody, or even if you don't know you've been around somebody who has tested positive? What's the value of the test if you're saying you should quarantine anyway?
So let's say that you just found out that several days ago you were in contact with somebody who is now known to have COVID-19. Immediately, you should quarantine yourself because you don't want to expose others. You should also get tested, because if you do end up testing positive, then we also need to be tracing all of your contacts too and the time that you could potentially be infectious. So testing is important. But just because you test negative right now doesn't mean that you won't test negative tomorrow, as in it takes time for the virus to build up enough in your body that it'll test that you'll get that positive result. And so that's why that quarantine period for 14 days is so important. Now, there are also asymptomatic individuals who don't have high concern for exposure. So, for example, what the president's team has always been doing, which is that daily testing. That daily testing is important for early detection, so you pick up on COVID-19 as early as possible. But remember that testing is detection. It is not prevention. That's why mask wearing, physical distancing, avoiding crowds, all that is still so important. And this is why we're seeing, unfortunately, that the president's aides, the president, the first lady, are testing positive. So even though everybody around them has been testing regularly, that's still not preventing the disease in the first place.
And we should say we're talking about a place like the West Wing of the White House, where the president and his staff work. It has narrow hallways, older ventilation system. People work in very close quarters. How much of a concern should that be in terms of an outbreak?
Well, those are all the makings for an outbreak. The highest risk for exposure are indoors, crowded settings, where people are not wearing masks, they are talking loudly with one another, they are gathered closely together, they're letting down their guard. And so all the settings that you're describing are exactly the settings that we are extremely concerned about. And of course, these individuals also are very mobile. They are, presumably, seeing their family and friends at home, but also they're going to other places. They're interacting with advanced staff and waiters and Secret Service agents and supporters and donors. And so contact tracing here is going to be extremely complex. And I just really hope that everyone will follow public health guidance, not try to take shortcuts, because those shortcuts will not work. I mean, this is the basics of public health. And now we've seen, if the president himself is infected, no one is immune. Everyone needs to treat this virus really seriously and know that we should be taking all these precautions.
What about Vice President Joe Biden, candidate for president right now? He was on stage with President Trump Tuesday night. This is at the debate. They were 10 feet apart, unmasked, but both speaking loudly. We know that shouting and singing, for instance, can send off droplets farther than 6 feet. How concerned should Joe Biden be right now? We should say he did apparently just test negative, but how comfortable would you be with that result?
I don't know that I would be comfortable with the result per se, and I'll come back to this, but I do think that the risk to Vice President Biden is very low. First of all, because the president did test negative that day. And again, even though the negative test result doesn't necessarily mean that he can't be contagious, it still is because he had been testing consistently negative before that. Presumably, he didn't have a very high viral load. And also, they were, as you said, 10 feet apart. And presumably, the setting that they were in was well ventilated. They didn't hug or shake hands or have other close contact. And so I think the risk of Vice President Biden having acquired COVID-19 from President Trump in that setting is very low. However, a negative test result 3 days after that exposure, or 2.5 days even after that exposure, is not particularly reassuring because of the incubation period of this virus.
So you're saying he should have another test?
And he should also use an abundance of caution when around others. He and his team should decide whether he should himself quarantine. But if he should not quarantine, he should absolutely get regularly tested.
Dr. Lena Wen, emergency physician and public health professor at George Washington University. Thanks.
Thank you.
New TV shows are coming out this fall despite the pandemic. The options are more limited, but Hollywood is grinding its way back into gear. Even Saturday Night Live is coming back with an audience right there in the studio, just like in the olden days. NPR TV critic Eric Deggans is here to talk about that and more. And Eric, first that. How is Saturday Night Live going to make this work safely with an audience right there?
Well, there's an online place where you can apply to get tickets to the show, to be there in person. And it's been that way for quite a while. And then once you get that ticket, you actually get tested. You have to take a test when you get there. It's self-administered. They'll do temperature checks as well. You have to have face coverings and masks at all times. And of course, they're going to ask if you've come from any states that are having problems with outbreaks, and if you've exhibited any symptoms of COVID or been around anybody who has any symptoms of COVID. But if you pass all of that, then you're allowed to actually attend. And I guess we'll see how well that works in screening out people who might have the virus.
Is it going to be full capacity, or are they going to be spreading people out in the audience?
I've been to several SNL tapings. That studio is small. You're not going to have hardly any audience if you have a great deal of social distancing, but I imagine they'll probably let in fewer people and distance the people that come in.
And presumably the cast is not going to be masked?
Presumably, yeah. As you noted, Hollywood is sort of easing back into production, and so casts and staffers are being tested regularly. And in fact, they even posted on social media photos of Chris Rock wearing a mask during a table read-through, I think, on Tuesday. So
Chris Rock, who's going to be the guest host.
Yeah, Chris Rock is the first guest host, and Megan Thee Stallion is the musical guest.
Let's move from comedy, Saturday Night Live, to docudrama now. There's a show that debuted this week on the streaming service AMC+. It's a British import called The Salisbury Poisonings, about an actual chemical attack on a former Russian double agent and his daughter in 2018. This is coming out against the backdrop of another alleged poisoning by Vladimir Putin's emissaries, that of Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny last month. He miraculously survived that. Eric, what do you think of the docudrama?
I actually think they've done a great job here. Basically, a man and his daughter fell ill in the middle of Salisbury, England. It's a relatively small town. And at first, they didn't understand what was happening to these people. And then they realized that they had been poisoned with a deadly nerve agent. And we have a clip from the show. Let's check it out. It's an expert letting everyone know exactly what they're up against.
If left untouched, it will remain lethal for a very long time.
How long?
About 50 years.
So if it's on a piece of clothing or...
Yes. You could go for days or weeks without touching the precise spot, but as soon as you do, well, you've seen the effects. In terms of protecting citizens, this is about as bad as it gets.
So what's interesting about this is that there's a lot of parallels between what we're going through now with the virus and their efforts to not only figure out where this substance is and how these people contracted it, but also try to keep anyone else from coming into contact with it. And of course, you know, the virus is much less lethal than this substance, but they had to do a lot of the same things in terms of isolating people and quarantining them, and sort of miraculously only one person died, and it wasn't the people that were targeted.
Eric, before we let you go, I want to talk about a show coming up in a few weeks, David Byrne's American Utopia on HBO. David Byrne was the front man of the Talking Heads. This is a show that hit Broadway before the pandemic. In it, he sings songs from the band, and he has new music there as well. This is a filmed version that was directed by Spike Lee. Do you think it works as a TV special?
Oh, yeah. It's a really specific sort of stage experience. He decided to present a concert where everything other than the people and their instruments was off the stage. So they use wireless technology so that the keyboard player can carry his keyboard. The guitar players don't have any cords. Everyone has wireless mics on their heads. And they all have choreography that is coordinating every moment on stage. And then towards the end, he does a version of Janelle Monáe's Hell You Talkin' 'Bout. And they call out the names of black people who have been killed. Let's listen to a little bit of it. And I have to say, you know, as a black man and as somebody who's written a lot about these issues, you know, I really felt myself getting emotional during that part in the show. And I think they just did an amazing job. I think Spike has done an amazing job directing this. And they even managed to add the names of some people who died after they filmed this concert, including George Floyd and Breonna Taylor.
That again is David Byrne's American Utopia on HBO. Thank you very much, NPR's TV critic Eric Deggans. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. This is Here and Now.
How will the news of President Trump's positive coronavirus test affect the presidential campaign with just about a month to go before Election Day? That's next time on Here and Now.